How would you define life? I mean, I don't know if any of you here want to just do one more crack at this and then we'll move on to something else, but Chris, the question I asked you before, why don't you have to define it if you're going to some other planet to look for it? How do you know what you're looking for?
I don't think we need to define it in order to be able to find it. I think, as Lee said, we can recognize it by the molecules it leaves behind. We don't need a definition, and I don't think a definition will be forthcoming. And you might take the view that we'll only get a good definition when we have more than one example on which to study. So I think the whole debate about a definition is a mistake. Let's just go out and look for it.
All right, so...
Roger?
So
Roger?
Why did you call this thing, What is Life, Lawrence?
Well, because it's a good question, but I think, in fact, it could change. For example, let me throw it in a completely different direction. When computers become conscious, which they will, my Mac is far closer than the PC. Will we call them life? And I think they'll object if we don't. I suspect.
Yeah.
I think the definition of life is a moving target.
All right. So Paul, I asked you before the break. Speak to this notion as well.
Yeah.
That people have actually written papers suggesting that there might be life as we don't know it actually lurking around on the planet. We just even don't realize that.
That was the idea I was trying to develop, that we can't be sure that all life on Earth is the same life. And after all, what we want is a second sample of life. And Earth is a great place to start looking because it's cheap to look here. Mars is another good place to look, but it's expensive to get there. And there's a problem also. Because, as Chris alluded to, the Earth and Mars trade rocks. So we have two Mars rocks right here at Arizona State University. So we know that material is swapped between these planets. And it seems very likely that microbes can hitch a ride in that material. The rocks, incidentally, get off Mars because Mars gets hit from time to time by an asteroid or a comet with enough force to splatter rocks around the solar system. So we know that there's a traffic of material between the two. It seems very likely if you have life on one, you'll get it on the other. So we may go to all the expense of going to Mars, find there's life there, but, oh, it just turns out to be another branch on the same tree of life as us. So it doesn't... You might find a different form of life on Mars, but you might find it on Earth as well. That's my point. Can I address... You said a definition of life. I have had a stab at a definition of life because... For me, the most important thing is about the information processing capabilities, because I know of nothing other than life or the products of life, like computers, that process what we might call semantic or contextual information. So that to me seems to get closest to the heart of what is really weird about life.
So does anybody here want to speak to the notion of artificial life? I'm thinking about Chris Langton now, or Tom Ray's Tierra and so on. Do you want to talk about that, Lawrence, the life in the computer?
Artificial life, you mean?
Artificial life, you mean?
Computer life.
What I just said, computer life? I mean, I think it'll share many characteristics. I think the difference is, but I don't expect it to be long. I mean, Craig has said for a long time the difference. I mean, he's doing software that makes its own hardware. And the difference with computer software is it doesn't do it yet. But once I think computers become self-aware, and once they can actually create the hardware, that they'll certainly become the dominant forms of intelligent life on the planet, I suspect. And then, in fact, biology will have to incorporate that in order to keep up. But that's in the future, 10 or 20 years at least. And But I think that it's hard to know. I don't know if Craig wants to add to it, but I would also say, I guess because of what Paul said, that it would be a bigger surprise, and you talked about looking for life on Mars, but it'd be a bigger surprise to go to Mars and find it wasn't our cousins, just because the planets have polluted each other, and it would be stuff from Earth has gone there, although it's harder, and stuff from there has come here. So if life can easily survive the voyage, which microbial life can, it'd be amazing to discover life on Mars that wasn't our cousin, I think.
So does anybody have a perspective on the directed panspermia hypothesis that Francis Crick and Leslie Orgel did? Where did life begin on Earth? I mean, did it come from somewhere else?
Direct.
What's the general opinion at this point? Richard, do you have a thought on that?
Well, I think that Francis Crick and Leslie Orgel's directed panspermia was largely tongue-in-cheek, but I think they wanted to make the point that if indeed, as at the time was thought, the origin of life on this planet was a very difficult problem, then you could as it were, spread the problem out by saying it could happen anywhere else. I mean, directed panspermia, in case anyone doesn't know, it's the idea that a civilization elsewhere in the universe tried to propagate its form of life and put its form of life into the nose cone of a rocket and shot it off, and it happened to land here. The universe is an awfully big place, and the chance of a rocket happening to hit one planet rather than just whizzing by all of them is pretty low. I don't think they ever thought it was a serious... I think it was kind of tongue-in-cheek to make a point.
Chris?
But I think Richard's right. The directed panspermia maybe was tongue-in-cheek, but the notion that life could be ejected, like Lawrence was saying, by natural processes and spread, which is just called regular panspermia, is getting more serious attention now, because as we study early life, it's looking more and more like life appears very early in Earth history at a very complete and complex level already. It seems like Athena springing from the head of Zeus fully formed. It's really quite a mystery, and it's forced some people to think, well, maybe it didn't develop here. It came here and landed here, and that's why we get this impression of incredible development and complexity so early.
Is Brittany Fox here anywhere? Okay, so she sent a question in on the Facebook, Twitter, or Origins Project website. I think this probably goes to Craig, but other people might want to comment as well. Ethically speaking, do you believe that life should be created in the laboratory? And more importantly, do you believe that life can in fact be created in laboratory setting?
That's easy. Yes. there's an interesting, being Darwin's birthday, there's an interesting quote in his book about that it would be much more interesting, I'd have to paraphrase it because I didn't bring it with me, much more interesting to study man-made variations of species than what occurs naturally, something to that extent, because what he was finding, I guess, in England was pretty boring.
But Craig, you've got a long way to go before you make all of life from scratch. You can make the genome part, that's the easy part, but all the other stuff, it's going to take a while, isn't it?
Well, it wasn't so easy, actually.
Easy with hindsight.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it remains to be seen. I think we have to cheat to some extent, because if we put the components in that can read the DNA, make the proteins. The ribosome is one of the most complex structures we have. And so just starting with the ribosome is sort of like building a new Ferrari and buying the engine from somebody else. But sooner or later, these simple information systems will get read. I mean, it is important, and we're discussing this at the break, is how much information transfers with the cell. Obviously, in terms of our species, quite a bit transfers with the cell. The mitochondria, the mitochondrial DNA is always just a maternal lineage. I think microbes are a lot simpler, and I think we will be able to totally create cellular systems from non-cellular systems and from synthetic molecules and synthetic DNA. That's still a very long way from creating life from scratch.
Right. Right. Craig, do we yet know what the minimal configuration is to make life?
You mean the minimal gene set?
The minimal gene set.
Yeah, we're whittling down on it, but there won't be a minimal gene set. There'll be multiple ones, because I'm not so sanguine as some of my colleagues here that there's only one life form on this planet. We have a lot of different types of metabolism. Different organisms. I wouldn't call you the same life form as the one we have that lives in pH 12 base that would dissolve your skin if we dropped you in it.
Oh, I've got the same genetic code. We'll have a common ancestor.
You don't have the same genetic code. In fact, the mycoplasmas use a different genetic code and would not work in your cells. So there are a lot of variations on the
theme. You're not saying it belongs to a different tree of life from me, are you?
Well, I think the tree of life is an artifact of some early scientific studies that aren't really holding up. So the tree, there may be a bush of life.
Yes.
Bush, a tree.
I don't like that word.
Richard, but that's only in terms
I concede that point. Yeah.
Yeah.
So there is not a tree of life. And in fact, from our deep sequencing of organisms in the ocean, out of now we have about 60 million different unique gene sets, we found 12 that look like a very, very deep branching, perhaps fourth domain of life. That obviously is extremely rare that it only shows up out of those few sequences, but it's still DNA-based. But you know, the diversity we have in the DNA world, I'm not so sanguine and ready to throw out the DNA world. I think we're going to, maybe like Richard was saying, we're going to find the same molecules and the same base systems wherever we look.
You, in fact, had a comment you wanted to make, Richard, I think.
Well, it's rather moved on. I was just going to say I can't imagine why anyone should think it was an ethical problem. I could see why they might think it was a problem of expediency. You might fear that it would, you know, escape and overrun the world or something. But ethical problem, I can't see.
Well,
but I'm now intrigued by Craig saying that he... I'm intrigued at Craig saying that that the tree of life is a fiction. I mean, the DNA code of all creatures that have ever been looked at is all but identical, and surely that means that they're all related, doesn't it?
Yeah.
All right. Look. Let me give you a specific question here. This is from somebody called Gus Holward, a filmmaker, who sent something onto the website, I think. If we could fully understand the origins of life, consciousness, etc., do you believe that that type of discovery would help strip away some of the enamel of religious and metaphysics? Or do you think that, like the Big Bang and other complex cosmological concepts of which we now have a deep understanding, it would simply fly over the heads of the masses and possibly further the gap between science and religion? That sounds like a Dawkins question.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it obviously ought to have the effect that the questioner says. Whether it actually would, I'm rather inclined to be pessimistic, as he is. I suspect that it wouldn't, no matter how fully you prove something, those people who are indoctrinated from childhood in their religion would never, ever give it up. Sadly.
Yeah, I think... Let me expand on that. I think we're already hearing. I think that we already, both of us are probably. I don't know if you've ever been, but I've been to the Pontifical Academy in the Vatican and for meetings, and they're already preparing to discover life elsewhere and incorporate it in Catholic theology, I think. And so I think that the I'm serious because it's going to happen, and they've learned the hard way. And so I think it will, for a lot of people, it will confront their notions. But I think I agree with Richard completely that I think it's unlikely that alone is gonna strip people of beliefs that that they already have based on. Well, I won't go on.
Do you have trouble convincing people, Chris, that given all the issues that there are on the planet and given the fact that we know so little about all forms of life on this planet, that we should still be lurching off in search of life in other directions?
Well, I think it is important to answer the question, why should we search for life on other worlds? And that's what I opened with, and I think it's important to have that question, both for us as scientists, but also to answer the general public. Why should we be spending a lot of money to search for life on Mars? And again, I go back to the fundamental scientific importance that might be derived by having a second biochemistry. I side with Richard on this and not with Craig Venter. I think there is only one type of life on Earth, one. And if we had two, that would be a lot more.
There's only one we know about.
Yeah, there's only one we know. Paul is right. There's only one we know. And I'm all with Paul. If we can find two right here on Earth, that's good. But I want to go to Mars anyway, so while I'm there, I'm happy to look for life there.
So here's a question from somebody. Do you believe Omoni Abu ASU student, do you believe that in the future there could be life on Mars or any other planets in our solar system?
There could be in the future, for sure. Yeah, I think Mars will inevitably be a biological world. It may be a biological world and populated by organisms with a Martian genome, or failing that, it will be a biological world populated by organisms with an Earth genome. Earth will share its genome. It will be the gift from Earth.
So this is the cover of the current Skeptic magazine, and the main story is the origin of life. This is New Scientist, just two, three days ago. There's a long piece in here on chemical creation of life. So the life factory, inanimate matter that can evolve before our eyes, could point to exotic new life forms. Why did you choose this particular subject? I mean, it seems to be quite hot at the moment. So.
Well, I tried to illuminate some of the ideas in my introduction. The point is that it's hard to imagine anything that touches us more deeply, a question, an origins question that is more direct than the origin of life on Earth and our own origins. And also, because as we're learning at the meeting we're having now, there are tremendous developments that are potentially not only changing our picture of our understanding of the origin of life, but likely to do it in the near future. And I generally think it's that fortune favors the prepared mind. And these kind of discussions are very important, because if they're going to create life in the laboratory, it's really important for people to understand the potential and what to worry about and what not to worry about. And finally, because, I was going to say it later, but I'll say it now, I think the true value of science and art and literature is to change our picture of our place in the cosmos. That's what makes being human worth being human. And that unifying aspect of trying to understand the origin of life really will ultimately change our understanding of ourselves. So it seemed to me a profound issue, and it was also a fun one. Yeah. So that was the.
I interrupted you. You had some other question. You just.
Yeah, I was gonna disagree with Paul. In fact, I'll make him a bet right now.
Yes.
I'll hold the.
And I don't trust Chris to hold. Richard, I trust to hold it. But I suspect in not only in a decade that we won't find a second generation.
No.
Life
what I said was, if it's there.
Okay.
If there is a second form of life on Earth, we could find it in 10 years.
So, okay.
Because it may not be there.
Yeah, no, I was going to say that in the next century, which is good because neither of us will collect,
right,
that we
right,
won't
right,
find yeah. any evidence for a second right, genesis. And the reason being twofold. One, at this meeting, I've become more and more convinced that maybe the mechanisms that have led to life have a reason. It's not just random, that DNA and RNA have the structure they do, and including the set of amino acids they do, for a real chemical and thermodynamic reasons. So I'm beginning to think that it may have been driven in that direction. But the other argument is that, you know, evolution says that successful forms rule out other forms, and the kind of life we know has been pretty successful, and I suspect it'd be pretty hard to find a niche, as far as we could tell, that even in the kind of life that you're talking about that lives in acid levels that would dissolve us is from the same tree of life. And life seems to have occupied every niche on the planet it could have, the kind of life that we have. And therefore, I suspect that even if there was another life form, it would have been crowded out by now. Those are the two arguments.
Darwin said it would have been eaten.
I disagree with that.
Darwin said it would have been eaten by us.
Yeah.
Not by us, but by...
But not if it, only if it's tasty, you see. And so if it's got radically different biochemistry, it's... Yeah. You know, and the left-right is a very good example of that. They could peacefully coexist. But you're right that life, as we know it, is spread into a wide geographical and parameter space, but it doesn't fill it out totally.
Yeah.
And this idea that you couldn't, you know, one form has to eliminate the other. The archaea and the bacteria have coexisted peacefully for, what, 2.5 billion years, 3 billion, I don't know. Do you know, Craig, how far back? To the branch point?
3.5 billion.
Yeah,
3.5
billion. 3.5
billion is old as far.
And, you know, in many ways they're in competition for resources. And it's true that if you look at the distribution of microorganisms, some are present in large abundance and others in small abundance, but they can. This remains a stable distribution. I see no reason why one would have to squeeze the other out.
Let me ask a practical question. It's fun to talk about this. It's great that all the research is going on. In terms of practical applications of this kind of thinking, I thinking more along the lines of what you're doing, Craig, now in terms of synthetic organisms. I mean, could you speak to the environmental impact of those sorts of things?
Well, part of what's driving it is, you know, other than these basic questions, is trying to find some alternate chemistries that will allow us to live on this planet a little bit longer. So we're trying to see if we can use carbon dioxide as the main starting ingredient for all future food and fuel. It is now for food, but it's a very inefficient process through plants and photosynthesis versus scaling that up through deliberate genetic engineering. And so if we can use CO2 and make hydrocarbons that can go into the ExxonMobil refineries, instead of taking that carbon out of the ground, we can eventually start to shift that equilibrium. But we have some real practical problems. And the example I give is, I was born in 1946, and there's now over 3 people on the planet for everybody that existed the year I was born. That we wouldn't have needed this size auditorium 64 years ago. And in 30 years or less, there's going to be just shy of 10 billion people. We can't provide food, fuel, medicine, clean water very efficiently for the close to 7 billion people we have now. So we need some new solutions. And people have been looking at naturally occurring organisms. People have studied algae for almost a century now, thinking it would provide these solutions. But algae don't exist naturally to produce these incredibly high concentrations of the specific molecules that are needed. But it's not hard in the laboratory to change things a millionfold synthetically. And actually design organisms and design the future of plants to do what we want them to do. So I think there are more than just a few practical purposes. It's our whole basic existence will depend on these and other types of scientific breakthroughs.
Yeah. Lee Hartwell, in terms of, I mean, your primary focus is on cancer and so on, but in that you're looking at the commonalities, the conservation of information from organisms, from yeast to humans and so on. Did what you learned in doing the research give you a different perspective on this question of what is life?
On the perspective of what question?
On the perspective of life and its value.
Well, we all value life. but with respect to the question of the origin, I find it just that the more we learn about cells, the more complex they seem. They're just incredibly complex things. And to, you know, go from what we can see today to try to reason where it came from, I think is really impossible.
Seth, have you had any thoughts on where your work is, how it impacts this particular discussion?
No, I don't have anything to say about this particular discussion. I do research.
Touché.
Not tonight. Let me jump in for a second and
sure.
Say that, I mean, in fact, actually, it's not... Sid should have something to say, because in his talk today, he was talking about how trying to understand RNA actually allow us to treat diseases in a new way, by using RNA to cleave and destroy certain diseases. And I think, and I was surprised that Lee didn't pick up on that not only I suspect the economy of the world will depend on the kind of software hacking that's done with DNA in the future, just as the present economy depends on the ones and zeros in silicon. But I suspect at the same time as the economy that our health in the future is going to be dramatically affected, our ability to fight disease and treat diseases, by exactly these questions of that the research that's being done by many of the people at this table.
It was a clumsily asked question. What I was trying to get at was that I read somewhere where I read your Nobel Prize speech and so on, that working with yeast and then seeing how similar mechanisms translated and so on and so forth gave you this wonderful sense of the connectedness of things, if you like. I wasn't trying to force lyricism into your mouth.
I see, yeah. No, that's certainly what is I think, you know, surprising, really, maybe it shouldn't be, but I think it was the fact that the fundamental chemistry of life and the fundamental, you know, thousands of functions that different cell types have are very, very similar to one another. There are extremes, but for the most part, all, for example, eukaryotic cells, animals, things like that, they function in very, very similar ways. And so you can take this Tinker toy set or set of Legos that arose, you know, at the dawn of certainly eukaryotic life and much of it before, and make all kinds of things out of it. And so what that means is that we can study, you know, study things in any system and learn things about ourselves, and that's pretty fascinating.
Yeah. The possibility of alternative microbial life on Earth, Paul, we did that, but how serious do you think?
Well, I'm relying on people like Craig to find it, you know, because he's going out trawling the planet. If anyone is set up to look for something seriously weird, it's got to be his outfit. You going to take on this challenge?
But we're only sequencing DNA and RNA.
I know.
Right,
so you've got to keep your eyes open.
You know, maybe you should say what you've done, because I find it fascinating what you've done with your little sailboat. Not that little. But it's just amazing with what one search is, how many new life forms have been uncovered. I don't know if it's clear to people.
Yeah, we've lost count, basically, because there's so much diversity in the oceans. But what we haven't published yet is we've been sampling very deep in the Earth, down to about this 120 degree Celsius barrier.
And how many kilometers is that?
Well, you can go down, depending on where you are, a mile to 2 miles.
You prefer miles, right. Right.
It's not real deep, but there's more life underneath the surface of the Earth than there is in the oceans, or certainly equivalent, right. Same densities. But the organisms are very different, and there's in the ocean we find this tremendous diversity, probably largely due to UV radiation. And deep in the Earth, we don't find the same clouds of diversity around the same organisms. In fact, getting a sample from Colorado, about a mile deep, an organism was close to being identical to one from a volcano in Italy. So maybe without UV radiation, without all these things that drive mutations, life is a lot more stable. And so we haven't looked for non-DNA, non-RNA life, but when you're isolating cellular life, there is nothing that shows up that's not in that category.
Well, but how would you know?
Because we do cell sorting down to the single cell level.
And you never see, and you test for DNA.
And we can sequence a genome from a single bacterial cell.
Ah, yeah. But you see, if you tried to sequence one, even that had a different genetic code, you wouldn't make any progress, would you? You'd move on to the next one.
But this is like trying to prove there's no God.
No. No, it's not.
No. It's a real question.
No, so for example, you can stain for DNA.
I'm trying to get Richard back in the argument.
Well, but I'm trying to put a research project here, you see. You can stain for DNA, is that right?
But you can't stain for no DNA.
Ah, but if you see a population of microorganisms and only a third of them are staining for DNA, you think, well, what are the other two-thirds?
They all have DNA in them.
All the ones you've looked at so far.
Maybe there's some invisible ones that we're not seeing.
No. You're not taking this seriously.
You don't see them because the way you see them is by staining their DNA.
Right.
We sort them down to single cells in the cell sorter, and we can grow them up from single cells.
Right.
We can do the genome.
You can grow them in a standard cell culture, but if they were radically alternative organisms, they wouldn't grow, and so you throw them away. It's self-selecting. If you go looking for A, you will find A, you won't find B. I want you to look for B.
I'm going to take this bet and say you're not going to find anything in the next 10 years.
Well, not if you don't put your heart in it.
Let me ask a question to everyone here, who I want to hear the answer to. I'm going to ask it so I don't have to answer it. Do you think in your lifetime, and that varies, that we will know the origin of life on Earth, the step by which non-life became life on Earth? Do you think we'll answer that question while you're alive? Start with Richard, maybe, and move down.
I'm increasingly optimistic, having attended the day's conference that you organized, Lawrence. I had hitherto thought of it as a rather remote possibility, but things seem to be really moving in an exciting way, as far as I can understand it. So, yes, I think it will.
Sid?
I think it's quite possible. The question is, as you said, how long are we going to live as individuals? And I don't expect to live that long. But I think it's very hard to make predictions about the future, as Yogi Berra said. But perhaps in 20 years we might understand something about the real origin of life. I know you want to go down this sequence, but I have another question for you, which maybe we can come to after Lee speaks.
No, go ahead. I don't have anything to say on this subject.
Well, okay. Why don't we go through here, and then you can ask your question.
No, I want to ask you the question.
Oh, you want to ask me a question?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, before you change the topic, I disagree. We're not going to know the origin of life on this planet. We're generating hypotheses, and the only way to test those is to see if we can recreate those conditions and that origin on another planet, or witness that it did take place. You know, there's some things we can do in science in terms of proving certain things about life we discover. Guessing what happened 4.2 billion years ago or 3.5 billion years ago, we can come up with a lot of good guesses. There's been a lot of good guesses floating around. It's impossible to prove it.
I have to really disagree there in the sense that, because I think it's part of the problem, partly of science and religion too, is that people have the wrong impression of what science is. That science tells a story, and it's a story like any other story. But the difference is, it's a story that makes predictions. So you can try and guess what happened in the past, but there's sometimes, based on those guesses, that you can make predictions about things you haven't measured yet. Say, if life formed this way, then I can do this experiment in the lab and observe something I haven't yet seen. And if I do that enough, and if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, and all my predictions are consistent with what I see, then I can say that I'm not post-dicting, I'm predicting.
No, but then Paul would say, well, you didn't look for the other life form.
But, Craig,
I think I agree we're unlikely.
I don't disagree with anything you said in terms of your last few statements. You're absolutely right about the things you said. But I think it's possible, again, from material we heard earlier today and what I know other scientists are doing who are interested in this topic, that we might have some information, put it that way, about the origin of whatever we call the origin of life 20 years from now or something like that. I agree with that. Yeah, I certainly won't say anything with certainty. There is another question, Lawrence, which I would like to ask you, which has nothing to do with what we were just talking about.
Okay.
You were talking about the future of computers and that they will have consciousness, which I don't understand at all. I don't understand what you mean by consciousness, but we don't have to talk about that right now. And knowing that you're a very erudite person and that you've probably read some of Isaac Asimov.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. Shouldn't we make sure that the three laws of robotics are imposed on our computers?
No, I don't. It always amazes me, and I'll bring in Star Trek because I'm contractually obliged, that we have this perception that somehow alien life, be it computer life, is always a threat, and that in fact that our future isn't their future. And so the part of the problem of Asimov's three laws is the assumption that doing away with humans is a bad thing, and it's not at all clear to me that that's a bad thing in the long term. Because I doubt 200 years from now that being human will have that much resemblance to what being human is now. And no matter what, whether we're computers get get intelligent or not. I suspect with what we'll be able to do in genetics, that the definition
you
of
could
humanity
say the same
will
thing,
evolve.
You could say the same thing about Benjamin Franklin, that he would have had no idea of what our life is like today. But I think that's partly
But he
wrong.
Didn't have the technology, and we don't have the technology we'll have.
Benjamin Franklin would understand what life is today, even though he wouldn't recognize it easily. And we will understand what life is like 200 years from now, even though it might be difficult.
Oh, yeah, but being a human may be very different. Than what it may have very little resemblance to what being human is today. And that doesn't seem to be, it's not a good thing or a bad thing. It just seems to me that what's possible is going to happen, and there's no sense trying to avoid it.
Well, I don't understand what you mean by what is possible and what we can or cannot recognize. We'll talk about this later.
Do any of you have any of you had any sympathy at all for the Gaia hypothesis that Jim Lovelock and Lynn Margulis put out some years ago, the notion of the Earth itself or the biosphere at least being a living organism?
None.
No
sympathy.
I didn't think you would. I thought nobody subscribes to that at all.
No, Richard agrees with me.
You can ask.
He's much more eloquent than I am.
I know.
In the weak sense, life has changed Earth. As I said, oxygen exists in the atmosphere only because of life.
Yeah.
So life is intimately connected. And as we learned at our meeting today, and geology is intimately connected with life. We've learned that the geological features of the Earth, in fact, dramatically affected the way life evolved. So there's an intimate connection between life and the planet, but some kind of cosmic New Age thing I'm not a big fan of. No.
Well, I want to defend Lovelock here for a minute. His real insight was that the cycling of the light elements on Earth, carbon and nitrogen, sulfur and phosphorus, were dominated and really controlled by biology. And he derived that insight when NASA asked him to be part of the search for life on Mars. He looked at Mars and saw a planet in which the elements were not cycled by biological systems. And he said, the big difference between Earth and Mars is on Earth, the light elements are under biological control, and on Mars they're not. And that is a very important concept for how to search for life. And now, effectively, that's how we will search for life around planets or on other stars, because of this effect that life will have in altering the environment, creating, for example, oxygen. And that oxygen on Earth is the simplest and most straightforward manifestation of Lovelock's idea. Now, it has evolved into this quasi-mystical Mother Earth sort of thing, but I think the root of it is solid science, and it's got to do with the fact that when life is present on a world, it takes over the whole world, and it is in command of the cycling of the light elements. And I think that's operationally a very important concept when we look at other worlds.
That's what Lawrence more or less said, that nobody doubts that the presence of life on a planet changes the conditions on that planet. What Lovelock said was that the Earth is a living system which actually regulates itself for its own good. I mean, that's a very much more radical thing. And Lovelock himself never said this, but John Maynard Smith told a wonderful story of how he was at a conference where there was one of those philosophical ecologists. His name was Goldsmith. You know who I mean, Roger.
Samuel Goldsmith.
Teddy Goldsmith.
Yes, I met Teddy.
They were discussing whether it was discussing the theory that a meteorite had hit the Earth and destroyed the dinosaurs and, you know, major catastrophe. And Teddy Goldsmith said, "Impossible. Gaia would never have permitted it."
Well, anything can be taken too far.
Yeah.
So, but there's an extract from some of your writings in this compendium I've been talking about. It's the Universal Darwinism thing, and since we are on February the 12th and Darwin's birthday, would you just sort of explain sort of? You actually think this principle is absolutely universal, right?
I conjectured that if there is life anywhere else in the universe, however weird and however alien and however strange it may be, the one thing I would put my shirt on is that it will be Darwinian life.
Are you going to hold this bet as well?
I'll agree with him that it will evolve. But the question I would put back is Darwinian evolution the only way to evolve?
Well, that's
a question, not a statement.
Yeah, it's a very good question. It's certainly the only way that's ever been proposed that would work. Now, there may be other ways that haven't been proposed, but the only other sort of candidate would be Lamarckian evolution, and that, in principle, couldn't work, even if the facts supported it.
Well, on that Darwinian note, I'm instructed that we should bring it to a close and thank the panelists very much.
Well, I want to thank the panelists, but I want to thank everyone for all of you for coming. And I do want to just say that this event is part of a continuing series, and there's three events I wanted to let you know about in the future. One's related to an event Paul is organizing, which is related to this. It's about life in this and other universes, I think. And it's
life's destiny.
Life's destiny
in this universe and others.
Lord Martin Rees, who's among any other things, the astronomer Rial, is going to be talking April 14th here. Associated with the alien thing we talked about, Lucy Hawking is here, and she's coordinating with Paul a contest for high schools, for students, to suggest what they would say in response to a message from aliens that we receive in SETI, to give Paul advice. And we hope to announce the winner of that contest at the next Origin event, which will be, as I've announced before, a major four-day festival of science and culture, April 8th to 11th, involving theater, music, film, and dance, with some rather spectacular events. So I'm not going to go into them here, but look out for them. And I think the reason I want to end with that is that the questions we've talked about, as I say, are not just scientific ones, they're cultural ones, and in my opinion, they're ones we should all be asking and be prepared to answer. But thank you very much for coming, and thanks to the panelists as well.